I'm Dick Buescher. I think you know that. And I've worked with the Forest Service in the Northwest for 34 years. And in that time, had lots of responsibilities in wilderness studies and wilderness legislation. And we're going to explore this whole rather unique American concept of, it was really a philosophical concept. Look at its roots and then look at that philosophy and how it became law, which is interesting in itself. And if we have time, we'll talk a little about this anomaly of wilderness management. And it seems like that when you talk about wilderness and I tell you what it's all about, and then we talk about managing wilderness. We really don't. We manage the use of wilderness. Those are three courses I usually do up here separately. So we're going to try to do 3 hours work in 1 hour. And so recognizing that I may move faster than you understand, stop me. And people that work with me closely in the Forest Service use the customary shut up, Bush, and to get me to stop, but just feel really free to get involved, because I'll make chances for that, but take your chances too. It's important to me that you pick up on some pretty precious happenings in this country that not everyone's very aware about. How many of you are from Middle West or East? The majority, or at least not about half. And then the rest of you are out west, California, Washington. Yeah. Okay. Hi.
Hi.
How you doing?
Fine.
How many think they know what wilderness is? In and I'm not talking about it generically now. I'm talking about specifically. Okay. That are informed, you know, about the act and so on. How many use wilderness? Visit. Okay, good number. Let me take you back to at least some approximate time all this started. And there's an interesting date, and it's 1854, and we'll start at that time, because some of the real early philosophy of the need for preservation, keyword, of wilderness, occurred in the pronouncements, one on the East Coast, which was more or less civilized and settled by Europeans, and the West Coast, which was more or less uncivilized. And the pronouncement in the East, and the words in the East, come from Thoreau in his writings at the Pond. And you'll hear those words briefly, and then, very interestingly, in the exact same year, you'll hear a few words from Chief Seattle on the West Coast, and it's a very interesting dichotomy to me. Thoreau was one of the first hippies in the United States. That's essentially how he was seen, as kind of a weirdo that lived out there on the pond and wore rags. And he was espousing the early concepts of the need for preservation. He made this statement, among many: "The kings of England formerly had their forests to hold the king's games. I think they were impelled by a true instinct. Why should not we, who have renounced the king's authority, have our national preserves, preservation, in which the bear, the panther, and some even of the human race may still exist and not be civilized off the face of the earth? Our forests, not to hold the king's game merely, but to hold and preserve the king himself also, the Lord of creation, for the idle sport or food, but for inspiration and our own true recreation or recreation." Kind of strange thoughts in 1854 on the East Coast when you think about your history, and we were in the job of conquering this wild world. We were in the job of exploiting its resources at that time and ever since. And along comes the words of Chief Seattle, if you have not seen this or picked it up in the bookstore, it's the best dollar and a half you'll ever spend. It's the full text. There are many quotes from parts of it that go around, but it's a message of Chief Seattle. It's been printed here at Holden in its entirety. Understand that it was written by an interpreter, but there's reason to believe that they are very, very close to the true thoughts and heart and meaning of Chief Seattle. So in 1854, a self-proclaimed savage, though he was far from that, said these words. Think of what Thoreau just had to challenge us. So if we sell you our land, and he, you have to understand Chief Seattle is responding to President Pierce in writing on the offer to steal with money the chief's land. And he said, so if we sell you our land, love it as we've loved it, care for it as we've cared for it, hold in your mind the memory of the land as it is when you take it, and with all your strength and all your mind and with all your heart, preserve it for your children, and love it as God loves us all. One thing we know, our God is the same God. This earth is precious to God. Even the white people cannot be exempt from the common destiny. We may be brothers and sisters after all. We shall see. So, I find those early voices of challenge to society to see the values of preserving in a natural state some parts of the United States before it was too late. I describe this as a uniquely American concept because, in fact, it is. We have exported from this country a whole lot of bad habits, and we all know that. One of the things we've interestingly exported is the concept of wilderness. Other nations have picked it up after us. So a very young society contributing to some older societies is interesting, and I'll give you some examples later when we get into the law and what that's all about. There are all kinds of definitions of wilderness and what its values are. Probably the most facetious came from Rupert Cutler, once an attorney for the Wilderness Society, who described it as a wilderness, that wilderness is a place where the hand of man has never set foot. And maybe the most philosophical, Roderick Nash, who's a well-known writer in wilderness and educator, says wilderness is a state of mind evoked by a state of nature, a quality associated by some people with some places. And so lots of definitions, but let's get in substance to what wilderness is really about and how it got to be. Beyond the two we've listened to, there were a whole lot of other champions that came on board, and it started with Thoreau, was picked up by Muir. And I'm going to close today with a quote from Muir, and this is another really excellent book in your bookstore, Baptized in the Wilderness, A Christian Perspective on John Muir. And John Muir was a guru, a nature boy, a philosopher. He was also a teacher. He, I believe, had a doctorate in geology, decided that teaching in an Eastern university was not what he wanted to do. He'd heard the stories of Fantastic West and particularly Yosemite. He walked from Chicago to New Orleans so he could catch a ship, worked his way around the Horn, got off at the dock and walked up in his wild beard and raggedy clothes and walked up. The first person he saw and he says, which way is the Yosemite wilderness? At which point they thought about committing him. And so Muir gave us pre-turn of the century, a lot of the early philosophy and the demand to protect nature very much for spiritual values. And there are other books in the library that are excerpts. He was a prolific writer, a colorful writer, creates word descriptions that almost transport you to the place that he's writing about, spent lots and lots of his time in the High Sierra. And so Muir was a special champion. He fought for the first national parks. Unsuccessfully to stop a dam in the Hetch Hetchy Valley, but successfully to create Yosemite and other parks. Interestingly, John Muir and the originator, really, of the Forest Service were debate partners. They were comrades that split, really, over two Christian ethics. Gifford Pinchot, who, of course, was the individual who caused the National Forest to become law and to become a reality using the power of his friendship with Theodore Roosevelt, brought a very, very strong puritanical utilitarian Christian ethic to the United States when he brought forestry to the United States and the concepts of forest management and the earliest forest education at Yale. And it was built on the Christian ethic that the fruits of creation were placed here for our wise use and hence should be conserved but utilized. He and Mirror were co-champions, as I say, for the natural world, but they split at that point, and they had there were really some classic debates, and there's a wonderful film now. I tried to get a hold of it, I would have brought it here, but there's a wonderful film now of the debate between the two. Gifford Pinchot took the Forest Service and the National Forest on the wise use but use concepts and utilitarian values. Mirror stayed to the spiritual. After them, interesting players came on board. Stephen Mather, first director of the Park Service, 1916, was an early champion of preservation of nature in the national parks, and that became the mission of the National Park Service. Their mission, ours is multiple use, use the resources. The missions of the national parks, two very different organizations with different lands, all your lands, their mission is preservation. That came from Stephen Mather. But within the Forest Service, there have always been rebels, and some would describe me as one. I don't know if I've earned the title, but some real free thinkers that didn't quite go along with the drum that was beating. And the first of these was the first landscape architect in the Forest Service, Arthur Carhart. And he really started in Minnesota, some of your country. There's always Minnesotans here. And was a champion that envisioned what is now one of the largest eastern wilderness, the Boundary Waters Canoe Area. But Arthur Carhart was sent out to make a plat for summer homes on a lake, a remote lake in Colorado, and to get a road built in there, and then they could advertise the summer homes, and people could all come and rent summer homes, having a wonderful time. And he came back and said, I'm not going to do that. That'd be a mistake. Instead of developing this lake, we should preserve it. Shortly thereafter, Aldo Leopold, Bob Marshall, came on the scene. Aldo Leopold was a fantastic individual biologist, again, marching to his own drummer. Sand County Almanac, which is also in the bookstore, is one of his many writings. Bob Marshall finally became the director of Wilderness and Recreation in the Washington office, then left the Forest Service and became the individual who started the Wilderness Society. So you find the roots of the wilderness movement in the National Forests, in the Forest Service, within those three individuals and others. That all occurred in the 30s and the early 40s. The first wilderness was created by the Forest Service, not by the Congress. It comes later. 1924, it was 40 years later that the Congress finally got a wilderness system for the United States. The Gila Wilderness was made under the urging of Aldo Leopold in 1924. And the Forest Service at that time was only 19 years old, and the first wilderness had already come on the scene. So very early on, there was a cadre of people that said, wait a minute, full utilization of these fruits of creation are not the best and wisest and only use and valuable use. So there were, within the service, champions. It led to about a 12 million acre area of Forest Service wilderness, classified now strictly just administratively by the chief, and therefore could be changed at later times, and that's why we ultimately get legislation, and wild areas. And the only difference in those was their size. If they were under 100,000 acres, they were a wild area. If they were over 100,000 acres, they were a wilderness. The aggregate of those units by 1964 was 12 million acres. In addition to that, the Forest Service set aside a large number of primitive areas, administratively classified, and that was kind of like, well, we're not sure what it's good for, so we won't do anything until we study it, which sounds like a typical government move, but it's a good one in this case. And so we had a whole scattering of primitive areas all over the United States. And these were, we haven't made our mind up yet, and we'll leave them like they are. But a growing concern among citizens that also became champions for the wilderness movement was that in times of need, Second World War actually became one of those, when we needed resources, be they mineral or timber, we would drop this administrative protection and we would go for it. And in fact, that happened. Not on a large scale, but in a few places. That exacerbated the feeling that, they were in jeopardy. And when things are in jeopardy in the United States, we do one thing. What do? We fight for them. And so a large coalition, really, of people within the agency and a small number of people within the agency and a fairly vocal small number of people within the citizen at large became champions and began to move toward legislation. The principal of these was an absolutely marvelous individual named Dr. Howard Zonheiser. And I'm going to very soon read the definition of wilderness in the Act. They're the words, and much of the Act are the words of Dr. Howard Zonheiser, working in a group of people about this size, hammering out each and every word, and actually creating a word that fit their need because there was none, and you'll hear that in the definition. The great tragedy is that Zonheiser died about 3 months before the signing of the Wilderness Act that he worked for over a decade to achieve. Bob Marshall was dead at that time, Aldo Leopold was dead at that time. So the real early champions all died at a relatively young age, particularly Marshall and Leopold. So they never saw the achievement of their work, but it was achieved. There were congressional champions. John Saylor, Pennsylvania, was one of those. There were many others. And 10 years, really, and 7 years of sharp debate over different versions of a Wilderness Act went through the Congress. One of the longest legislative histories for any act we have. And the act was finally signed, and I worked during that period on a lot of the early efforts out here in the Northwest, and a little bit on some of the language, and then later on the regulations, federal regulations that followed the act. But during that period, there were all kinds of compromises cut, and those compromises are in the law, and they leave us with some difficult management situations. For example, the committee that had to handle the legislation happened to be chaired by an Arizona senator, and the Arizona senator, of course, had great interest in mining because his constituency did, and that's who he worked for. And so there were mining exceptions in the wilderness law, which became very difficult to manage, and I'll give you some examples that when we get into the act. But there were exceptions for grazing. There were exceptions for, the only commercial use was made for outfitters and guides who existed in relatively large numbers and saw wilderness as placing their livelihood into jeopardy. So there were a whole series of exceptions hammered out over this 10 years. But the essential element of what wilderness was to be hung together, and Zonheiser and the rest of the champions that wrote the language were able to hang on to that. And I'll read the purpose and just the purpose and the definition of the act, and you'll begin to appreciate what we have in this country and why it was exportable to other countries. The purpose, statement of policy, start of the act. In order to assure that an increasing population accompanied by expanding settlement and growing mechanization does not occupy and modify all areas within the United States and its possessions, leaving no lands designated for preservation and protection in their natural condition, it is hereby declared to be the policy of the Congress to secure for the American people, for present and future generations, the benefits of an enduring resource of wilderness. Okay, key words. Then Zonheiser's definition, and all of those that worked with him, is this phrase, and when you think you're reading from or listening to the laws of the United States, this is closer to poetry than law. A wilderness in contrast with those areas where man and his own works dominate the landscape is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. Okay, the word I said that they coined for the act is untrammeled. It's not untrampled. It's untrammeled. Anybody know what a trammel is? You know what a trammel is? Anybody?
It's a net for fishing.
You've got it. That's right on. Trammel is a net for fishing. And so it is, so it contains. And the whole spirit was freedom. This is terribly important when we get into management philosophy of the Forest Service about wilderness. But it is to leave it untrammeled. Not just untrampled, which is what we think about because we manage footsteps. But to leave the greatest amount of freedom possible and to leave nature operate at nature's terms and not our terms. And it goes on then and sets up as a definition not only for the areas that went in instantly, and that was the 12 million acres, by the way, that existed, that the Forest Service had made. They became the instant wilderness system. The wilderness system today is 90 million acres. The first 12 million came from the already established Forest Service wilderness. Okay, an area of wilderness is further defined to mean in this act an area of undeveloped federal land retaining its primeval character and influence without permanent improvements of human habitat or human habitation, which is protected and managed so as to preserve its natural conditions, for which generally appears to have been affected primarily by the forces of nature, with the imprint of man's work substantially unnoticeable. Excuse me for the gender-specific language, folks, but it's the law of the land. They wouldn't be written that way today. Two, has outstanding opportunities for solitude or a primitive and unconfined type of recreation. Each and every one of these words has been litigated now over interpretation. Three, has at least 5,000 acres of land or is of sufficient size as to make practicable its preservation and use in an unimpaired condition. And four, may also contain ecological, geological, and other features of scientific, educational, scenic, or historical value. So it gives no primary value in wilderness. And it is often thought by users of wilderness, the primary reason for it being there so we can have a primitive backpacking trip. But in fact, its scientific value is a benchmark upon which all other natural science can be based, because it is a natural area unaffected by us except for exterior influences like acid rain and other things we dump on it. It retains its importance in cultural resources, be the archaeological or history, and it has an opportunity for unconfined forms of recreation. Those are all co-equal in the act. I'll demonstrate to you that there's an unuttered value of wilderness that may be the highest of all. And probably my association over the years with Holden and my recent years on staff and conducting a wilderness spirituality retreat with a young pastor from back east has struck me how important the spiritual value of wilderness is. One of the early framers of the act, along with Zonheiser, was Sigurd Olsen, another Minnesotan, and an eloquent person. I'll read a fairly long quote, but one that gives some real insight into this concept of the spiritual value. We are trying to bridge the gap between our old racial wisdom, our old primeval consciousness, the old verities, and the strange conflicting ideologies and beliefs of the new era of technology. It is here that wilderness will play its greatest role, offering this age a familiar base for explorations of the soul and the universe itself. By affording opportunities for the contemplation of beauty and naturalness, as well as further understanding of the mysteries of life in an ecologically stable environment, it will inculcate reverence and love and show the way to humanism, in which man becomes at last an understanding and appreciative partner with nature in the long evolution of mind and spirit. And so the concept of spiritual value was within the framers and the architects of the act. The words didn't end up in the act, but the values were always there. And so on September 3rd, 1964, President Johnson signed the Wilderness Act after 10 years of really wild debate. I have a copy of the legislative history of the Wilderness Act, and it's about that high in governmentese. And all of the markup documents, everything. And it's a fascinating history. I always remember the date September 3rd, because I was married on September 3rd, and I spent my first honeymoon and my successive first 25, I think it was, anniversaries in a wilderness setting. However, we were married 8 years prior to the act, so the Congress did us a really swell thing of giving us an 8th anniversary present by signing the act on our anniversary. So I never forget the date. But the establishment of wilderness was of the 12 million acres was a very small beginning. I said there are 90 million now. Okay, over the years, how did it grow? The act required, made the 12 million, then it required the Forest Service to look at all of those primitive areas I told you about and assess and recommend within 10 years which should be wilderness and which should not. And each and every one of those was a battleground. The Park Service was told they had no wilderness at the time. They were told to study all national parks and monuments and recommend wilderness status. Park Service saw wilderness at that time as a redundancy and a nuisance to them. And they did not enter that effort with great spirit. It also turned out that even when they did not get the job done in 10 years, but nobody seemed to care because national parks already had strong protection, there was no great political benefit for Congress in making wilderness and national parks. So that has still languished. Many of the large parks, I believe including Yellowstone, do not yet have a wilderness bill. The parks in this state got a wilderness bill when Senator Evans decided not to run again and wanted to give the state a gift, and because he has a very strong environmental commitment, so he passed a bill that put over 90% of the three national parks in this state in wilderness. The National Park Service since that time has taken a very strong interest in wilderness management. We now conduct teaching. I'm on a wilderness committee with the National Park Service, and we teach the National Park Service wilderness management. And we're getting our act very closely together. The act also required that all of the fish and wildlife reserves around the United States and in Alaska, and the very large ones, be studied for wilderness. The act required that. But then what happened is after 64, and the purpose of making wilderness in 64 was get those very best areas, the most natural areas that we have, bring them into the system, and then flesh out the system from the three sources I mentioned. Fish and wildlife reserves, national parks monuments under the National Park Service, and the primitive areas in the National Forest System. That looked like the finite limits of the wilderness system, but it wasn't that at all. Each and every time a land debate came up, whether it was over timber harvest or a road or a mine, it then became a citizen's effort to stop something that wasn't wanted to happen. So wilderness started to become the tool by which you stop something you didn't want to happen, or a dam. And so the wilderness system began to have additions made on a single piece of legislation basis. The important thing is that generally none of these pieces of legislation changed the basic act. They only added to the system. And I was a part of one of those as a study team leader in the Alpine Lakes Wilderness in this state, a fantastic area just outside of Seattle. And we added a third of a million acres with that effort with a single piece of legislation. And I ended up writing the bill for that act, a congressional request. And so we were careful not to make exceptions to the wilderness law. And so the system is still a building. And I'll give you just a picture. By the way, it's 90 million acres and it's in 44 states. Does anybody want to guess what states does not have federal wilderness? Guess. Anybody here from Iowa? There's no wilderness in Iowa. Delaware, Maryland, Connecticut, Iowa, Kansas, that figures. And I hope there's nobody from Kansas. Connecticut, Rhode Island, Delaware, Maryland, Kansas, and Iowa.
You got three people here from Kansas.
Sorry, why don't you get some wilderness? You may, who knows? Maybe the tall grass prairie, something. Yeah. But it's spread all over. They're color-coded by agency, but and a lot of them are little dots. Believe it or not, some of them are a single rock off the Oregon coast, or is in the wilderness system, because it happened to be it's a part of what they call the Oregon Islands Wilderness. It's a Fish and Wildlife Service bird refuges. And each and every one of the rocks, when you look out off the Oregon coast, almost all those are in the wilderness system. By the way, you can't enter. There are parts of the wilderness system not available for entry. The Giant Condor Range, a part of the wilderness in California, had humans excluded from entry of 45,000 acres to try and protect the condors. It didn't work because the scientists were allowed to enter. That's another story. I hope there's no condor scientists here. I'll have a chance to insult you all three of them. So, 90 million acres, more being added. And I didn't name one of your lands, federal lands. And they manage the largest single piece of federal lands, larger even than the 190 million acres of the Forest Service. And what agency is that?
BLM.
You got it. And so, BLM was not included. There was and it couldn't have been more wrong, but there was a general national belief that BLM only managed the junk that was left over when they made the national forest and national park. And it's really absurd. Some of the most fantastic lands in the United States are in the public domain managed by the BLM. And these lands are much of the desert country, some fantastic geologic lands, some of the closest thing we have to original prairie. So an act was passed that gave BLM a charter and the obligation to study their lands and report to the Congress for wilderness. And that process is culminating right now in recommendations to Congress, and their studies are more or less done. They did a thoroughly professional job. They came to us, got a lot of our experiences, some not so good, some of our good experiences, learned from us, and set out and did a very determined job of studying their lands for wilderness. The current director of the BLM has an interesting background in that he would be on Gifford Pinchot's side of wise use, but he's become a real champion for wilderness in the BLM because he sees it as a white hat opportunity for BLM, and he sees the value of the lands, and I give him credit for that. I gave a keynote speech at the 25th Wilderness Anniversary so I could have a belt buckle. And the heads of the four managing agencies of wilderness were all there, and I would say that he was as big a champion of the other three. And so BLM is coming on fast, and you're going to see a considerable amount of land added as additions to the wilderness system. 56% of the acreage of the 90 million is in Alaska, where the huge wildernesses are, like Gates of Arctic National Park and so on. The rest in the lower 48. So, what do you know about wilderness? What can you not do there? And picking up on the language of the Act, what can you not do there? What isn't allowed in wilderness?
You can't permanently live there.
Yeah, there's no permanent habitation. That's in the definition, yes.
No motors, no mechanization.
Exactly. No motors, no mechanized use, and that includes bicycles, and that was
no
a very...
No airplanes, too, isn't it?
Pardon?
No airplanes above...
No, we have no, unfortunately, we have no control over airspace. What we get from FAA is an advisory on the pilot's maps that requests that they fly a certain elevation above. What you cannot do, though, you're correct in this, you cannot use an airplane or a helicopter to drop cargo, drop a camp, or drop people. So no delivery from an airport, an airplane of any kind, but we have no control over airspace. Unfortunately, it's a major issue with military aircraft over the Cascades. And they nearly killed two people that they unhorsed in the Mount Jefferson Wilderness here 2 years ago. And I've had some pretty close calls when on horseback. But that's unfortunately not one of the situations. However, there is an effort by the Park Service to place some controls right now on the overflights for recreation purposes in Grand Canyon. And you may have been reading about that. What else?
What is the recommended altitude for private planes? I saw a couple of float planes go by the other day, and I thought they look up and down.
Yeah, they're flying over Lake Chelan, which is not in the wilderness, but there's wilderness. Oh, did they? Oh, okay. Well, they were flying from probably Lake Whatcom. Yeah. And I think it's 2,000 feet, but in some places I think it's 5,000 feet, and it varies. We tried for 5,000 feet over Alpine Lakes, and I can't remember whether we got it or not. That's a particular problem because it's right on the hub going into Seattle.
Are we talking above sea level or above the ground?
No, above the ground, above the highest point. But no. Well, that'd be another way to cure it, wouldn't it?
5,000 feet.
So we're not trying to kill them, just keep on. But so what else can't you do in Wilderness? Before we talk about what it, you know, we talk about what its values are, but we'll talk about too how it's used. But anything else comes to mind. So no motorized use. I said there were exceptions.
No roads.
No roads, that's right. However, there are wildernesses with roads in them. Because the Congress took a more liberal view of the definition than we do, and they sometimes included roads when it sought them. They included logging right down the valley that I watched happening in 63, and I came back and drew a boundary that included it. But most of you can't see it, so we didn't really worry about that. So in some cases, Alpine Lakes has a short mining road in it, but it's gone back to nature. And so, but you can't build any roads in it, nor can you use a road that is there. We either put them back to nature or let them go back. Mining was permitted, and it went like this. From 64 to 84, all claims that were already established there, you know, were claims. They had legitimate status until proven otherwise, and there's a process to do that. As long as they were filed according to the 1872 mining law, which is kind of a permission to steal. And that's being debated in the Congress right now. Then there was the right to prospect, to find mineral, file a claim, okay, under the 1872 law. That was allowed for 20 years, till 1984. You can no longer, since December 31st, 1984, file a claim. You can go up there and find the largest gold nugget in the world, and you cannot file a claim. You just better pick it up and go. Not really. Belongs to the people of the United States. You cannot take possession of minerals in wilderness after 84. But, if you had a legitimate claim, had done all the things to prove it up each year that are required by the law, then you could still mine. Or, if you had patented the land, it had gone to patent, which means you received fee title for the land, and we have a classic example right over the head of the valley, and it went into private ownership as an inclusion, then you own the land as if you owned it in your hometown, in the place you have your home. The mine on Miner's Ridge is one such case, and it's owned by a large copper company, and every once in a while they kind of rattle the saber and talk about maybe they want road access, and the wilderness law guarantees the right of access for internal landowners. So that's a, you know, that's a terrific anomaly. What's happened in most cases, not all, is that Congress is implored by citizens to buy the land, and in the case of gypsum claims in the Three Sisters, that's what happened. There are other cases around the United States where Congress appropriates money and the United States buys the land. Interestingly, there is no right of condemnation within wilderness. One of, obviously, the government has eminent domain and can use condemnation on private land for public purposes when it's essential. That right within wilderness was taken away by the wilderness law from the agencies as one of the compromises, because one of the great fears was they'll immediately condemn all the private land. And so they took that away. I told you that I worked with the Congress to write the Alpine Lakes Act. By a quirk of the way we wrote it, for lands outside that were checkerboard, that we were directed to acquire and add to the system, we wrote the language in such a way it gave us condemnation authority within the Alpine Lakes. So it's the only place in the wilderness system where we have condemned land, and I've been at three straight court cases, all of which have been successful in the sense that we got the government estimate for the land and not a huge inflated estimate. Juries have changed their attitude about condemnation cases apparently in recent years. It used to be you paid dearly. Fields Point would be a good case in point. So wilderness is natural preservation of ecosystems, and that gets us to some other things. I'm going to do a whole session on the role of fire. I'll catch you in just a minute. Yeah, go ahead.
What about grazing?
Okay, yeah, grazing. Grazing's a really interesting one. Grazing is allowed under the law with no such 1984 date. no ceiling date, grazing continues. It's subject to the rules of any national forest lands under grazing permits. So that we started practicing with a much stronger constraint on grazing, and the Congress of the United States said, no, you're over interpreting the act. We got a congressional redirection that told us to soften up our constraints on grazing. That's a very interesting precedent because we have some concerns about that being also applied to recreation. We operate from a very pure stance in managing the recreation use of wilderness. And I'll give you a few principles under which we operate that are different than the Park Services. As we age, people want more comfort and more ease of entry. They want a more democratic opportunity to use wilderness if you like. There will potentially be some outcry that the Forest Service is being too constraining and the Park Service on use and a potential that Congress would be asked to soften. We have no intention of dropping the so-called purity interpretation because we think the life of the wilderness system is essentially built on that. And when you start making exceptions and exceptions, it's kind of like divorce. Pretty soon you wonder if you have a marriage law. It would be very soon you'd wonder if you have a wilderness law. So we will stand firm.
When was that congressional change in direction?
About 10 years ago. And it was, I think, called the Church Guidelines. No, that's another one. But it was led by a senator in Idaho and had strong support from Western congressmen. It was not a law. It is a congressional direction, and the threat is if you don't follow it, you'll get a law, and that would be worse.
Are there regulations about how many people can be in and go through?
No. Though we do use, well, actually, I gave you too simple an answer. There are size of party limits, okay? And they are specific to wildernesses within the National Forest System, but there is a general overriding regional policy, and then we write exceptions one way or the other. But it's essentially 20 heartbeats, okay? That's the easy way of dealing with people, horses, and mules, okay? So 20 heartbeats. And then some are down to 12. And so it depends on where you are. And what the condition of the wilderness is. So that size of party, though, all you'd have to do is string out 40 Boy Scouts well apart and never get together, and you know, and some of that may go on. But that's because we're trying to take the physical impact of camping is the most difficult one. Walking through wilderness is not the problem. Most cases, even riding through, it's when people stop that you begin to get impacts on the wilderness. And so there is a limitation on numbers. The way we manage numbers in wilderness when we feel we have to, we have only one case in this region because I'll give you our philosophy of management and you'll see why. We will turn as a last choice regulation to managing by permit. There is no permit required in Region 6 to enter wilderness except in the encampments outside of Leavenworth. And that was a very special case. We had strong support from the user groups and the users of the encampment and we had a good piece of research that demonstrated 60 people at one time as capacity. It's a relatively small, high, uplifted, fabulous piece of land with almost no real vegetation, virtually devoid of vegetation. And so if there are 60 people there and they're well scattered, you essentially have solitude. Beyond that, you have no hope for it. There is almost no soil. It's one of the few places in the wilderness we actually have installed toilets in their vaults, and we fly them out with helicopter. That's a very unusual circumstance. I know of one other wilderness in the West where that's a practice. And in that one, it was embraced in the law as a direction. But so we manage numbers when we have to, and there are going to be some wildernesses in Region 6 in our region, Pacific Northwest, added to a permit system. The Three Sisters, Mount Washington, and Mount Jeff will be the next to have a permit system. It's about 2 years away. And because, again, too many people. Okay, we feel the best way is to limit to a capacity number and then leave people freedom when they get there so that you're guaranteed that you'll have solitude and all the other things that the Act guarantees you by managing people before they get there, rather than telling you where you got to camp, how long you can stay, and all of the bureaucratic control that comes with that, and the feeling, I think, of taking really wilderness experience away. So I believe the Alpine Lakes is 2 years away from a wilderness system as well, with Seattle, you know, growing to the size it is, being the hyperactive city that it is. No, there's no way we can keep that backdoor wilderness without a permit system. So it's a matter, I think, of 2 years. But our whole philosophy is based on really trying to manage wilderness from the outside as much as possible. And by that I mean education. We've given awards to people here at Holden because of the no trace camping ethic that they have taught. And Holden Village manages numbers to wilderness, as you know. You just can't go walking up there. You go through the hike house, and there is a capacity that's managed by Holden itself. My staff and I have gotten together to give you a really good example of managing wilderness from the outside. I brought my staff here for a week. We joined with members of the long-term staff at Holden and the local district ranger and his staff, formed into teams and wrote a conceptual plan for the management of this whole valley from the lake to the wilderness. And in that conceptual plan is a whole series of trails on this mountainside behind us, which is a fabulous ecosystem. It had been a marvelous place to be last night in the moonlight. Mm-hmm. Because you can go to the basin if you want to, you still don't see the mountains. You're still seeing false summits around you. When you get on that ridge, you see the North Cascades. And it's a sea of peaks as far as the eye can see in all directions. So our dream, and I left this, I drew the additional boundary to the Glacier Peak in 84, and I left that ridge out solely to leave that opportunity available to us, so that we can have an ever-increasing level of difficulty loop trails that would march up that mountain and provide different opportunities for people of different skills. And the grade, would the difficulty in grade and narrowness of the trail would increase in the loops higher up on the ridge, probably with nothing but marked routes on the top with rock cairns and no treadville. So that is managing from the outside, because what we do then is provide a deflecting magnet for users that get a fantastic experience, one in fact you don't get unless you go to the high peaks in the wilderness and get away from the lakes, and therefore take pressure off the wilderness. Many of us that have worked in the wilderness movement believe we need another national system called backcountry. And there have been some champions in the Congress for backcountry. Senator Hatfield was one. I've written two different versions of a bill for him. I think we need backcountry, and I intend to work on it after I retire. So we would establish a system of roadless areas that would accommodate people without the constraints of wilderness. We might have hostels there. We might well allow people to have heli-skiing, whatever fit the environment of the area, and would allow a deflection from the people that want a primitive experience but don't need wilderness to have it. So, what else?
How differently are the different regions handled as far as up in the Northwest as opposed to the Appalachians, let's say, with wilderness areas or even backcountry?
Okay. We operate, staying within Forest Service now, because we operate under Secretary of Agriculture's regulations, Title 36, which I helped write after the 64 Act. All elements of the Forest Service, every unit of the Forest Service, is bound by those regulations, one set of regulations. The Secretary of Interior also has a set of regulations for the National Park Wilderness. It is more constraining on the user and less constraining on the Park Service than ours. We manage with the same ethic we demand of the user. For example, we don't use chainsaws except in exception cases. And I write the exceptions in this region, and it takes an environmental analysis to be able to use a motorized tool in wilderness in Region 6 or any place in the Forest Service. It is not it is a retained authority at the regional level, and we rarely grant it. Sometimes do. And only then for safety or protection of the wilderness, not economy. Economy is irrelevant. One of our philosophies is an important value of wilderness, and it sounds strange to some people, is it gives us an opportunity to retain old skills, primitive skills. There wouldn't be a crosscut saw manufactured in the United States today if it wasn't for the Forest Service. We are the biggest purchaser of crosscut saws. There's one place in Vermont that lives off of our business. it still turns out high-quality steel. There wouldn't be a person in the United States, except a few older people, that even knew how to set a saw. We maintain the use of the cross-cut straw, the cross-cut saw, the star drill, other primitive tools, using draft horses instead of cats to build bridges, and so on it goes. We actually give an award in a competition, national competition and a regional competition, to the unit or the individual that has the best representation of a project achieved with primitive skills. So we think it's another important cultural value of wilderness, is the preservation of those ingenious ways of getting work done without mechanization. So we impose the same strict authority on ourselves. We rarely have a cabin for wilderness rangers. In Region 6, we have virtually none. We have about three in the Pasayan, and each one of those is in jeopardy. I made a visit 2 years ago, and we may not perpetuate those. National Park Service builds cabins readily, uses helicopters readily, and uses motorized tools readily because they follow a different set of regulations and philosophy. That's not a critique, by the way. That's different, and obviously I don't agree with them, but that's beside the point. It's, you know, the law gave us the authority to do it either way. We chose the primitive way. Yeah.
Are you involved in Region 6 in the new administrative proposal for the wilderness areas? The reason I ask is, mm-hmm. I live right at the edge of Selwood Durban,
right,
which is in two different regions.
Right.
They've got three or four national forests. I don't know how many districts. And there's it's chaotic administration.
Yeah. They have one plan, but you never know it.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, our director went over there. No, that was River and No Return. That's another problem. At the same time. The Frank Church. And tried to help them through that. We have some situations in Region 6 which were a problem, where we had more than one unit administering it. I talked about the three Oregon wildernesses that are going to have a permit system. Okay, that was a case where we had a difference in management between the Willamette and the Three Sisters, or the Willamette portion of the Three Sisters and the Mount Jefferson and the Deschutes portion. We put one woman in charge of a study team that worked for all the rangers. We put a single plan out, and we really solved that problem. We did the same thing in the Alpine Lakes. We have a single plan operated by two units, five districts, that's working pretty well. There is a debate right now about when to put the permit system on. So we haven't got it all together. Not as chaotic as that. The Congress concerned about that, and there was a GAO investigation of wilderness management. One of their recommendations is, in multiple use wilderness management situations like that, create a single wilderness entity. I am not in favor of that, because one of the strengths of wilderness management and Forest Service is, you know, the manager has to have a little religion in this. And if you've got wilderness, you get religion. If you take all the wilderness out of the national forest, you know, take that portion out, put it in one entity, then you got national forests that have no wilderness responsibility. And I find that a major loss. And so I think that's not the way to get there. I think it's to get our act together and to have some citizens help us get there. And if you do that, you'll serve wilderness well. Yeah, Barbara.
I was wondering what your feelings are about the whole question of horses. I know I've asked you this before, but yeah. I've just been on a couple hikes recently where it seems to me like horses have done significant damage. Horse groups, obviously, the horses. Like in Emerald Park and the Sheep Drive Trail and also Image Lake. And I realize the culture of the forest has included horses for centuries, but it seems like it's not in keeping with the spirit of preservation to allow horses a lot of the places they're allowed now.
Again, they're an exception allowed under the Wilderness Act, but we make decisions on whether they're going to be there or not. And we have a fair amount of wilderness in which horses are not allowed. The Enchantment would be the best example I can think of. We have quite a few trails that are closed to horses because they may well be in the wrong place to accommodate horses, or they take horses to a place that cannot have the carrying capacity. Larch Lakes, Ewing Basin in the Alpine Lakes Wilderness would be such a place. The trail's suitable, but the arrival place is not. And so we manage horse use based on whether we believe that the wilderness can tolerate it or not. I'm going to be on a horse for 4 days and 100 miles in the Pasayan Wilderness next week. I'm going to be real glad to have him. That's real horse country. and it accommodates horses very well. We have made major, major strides, and back to this managing wilderness from the outside. Wilderness belongs to people, doesn't belong to Forest Service. And so people have a heavy responsibility. With that ownership, you get lots of responsibility, and that is to get your act together. The horse people have done a tremendous job of policing their own people, and they've written manuals on behavior. They do major cleanup jobs for us. They will discipline with peer pressure and otherwise horse people that are not playing by the rules. I frankly think that the whole pattern of horse use is on an uptrend. The whole pattern of backpacker use is on an uptrend because we've got people who care. And it's the only answer. We can put 100 wilderness rangers out there and we'll succeed in one thing, ruining the visit. Because you're not, the law doesn't say that you're going to meet nature on the bureaucrat's terms. It says you're going to meet nature on nature's terms. And I believe you got a right to die out there. And so I don't think that the answer is more supervision or any supervision within the wilderness. It's education on the outside, cooperation, and it's working. I'm very upbeat. We've got a lot more people in the Alpine Lakes today, probably by the tenfold, than we had when I first visited there 30 years ago. And Forest Service behavior is a lot better because I can remember Forest Service strings picketed the trees on the shore of Wauptus Lake, which is now closed to camping for 200 feet from the shore. And so we changed our act. We were the only people out there. And a good bit of the Forest Service behavior in wilderness was not to be admired. And so we taught ourselves, we learned with the public, and we're accommodating many more people with much less impact. I believe in Alpine Lakes there's still too many people and we're going to have to limit it. But, you know, and then rely on good behavior. No trace is working. Let me close with a quote, and then if any of you want to wrap a little more on this, we can. But I've really come to realize, I think I always knew it inside myself because I've lived in wilderness, I've worked in wilderness, I raised my family literally in wilderness, and taught my children responsibility and awareness of nature, and a lot of other things that I think I couldn't have done as well anywhere else as in wilderness, and I was just privileged to be there all the time by my work, and they accompanied me. But I think as a family and as an individual, I knew that a great amount of my attraction had to do with my own spirituality. I never put that in words in a lot of the teaching I did and all the rest till I started to come here to Holden and got involved with some really good thinkers and philosophers, individuals I worked with, people that were on the retreats, the ideas we shared, and I began to do more reading, and I found out I think that the paramount value of the wilderness system as we know it and as we have exported it now to Canada, we have inspired some of the national parks in Africa. New Zealand has been interested in copying the system. We are exporting the concept. But I really believe that the ultimate value in our society, and as hectic and stressful as it's become, and how much we realize we've messed up the non-wilderness part of the United States, we have an obligation to fix it. I think wilderness is that grand reminder of what creation was when it was given to us. And this very short quote from Mirror, which was written on this little narrow shelf, and if you read Mirror, he called it the Sunnyside Bench near Yosemite Falls, and he used to climb there and often spent the night just to contemplate things. And in 1873, he wrote these words, and we'll close with these, and then I will hang around. We seem to imagine that since Herod beheaded John the Baptist, there is no longer any voice crying in the wilderness. But no one in the wilderness can possibly make such a mistake, for every one of these flowers is such a voice. No wilderness in the world is so desolate as to be without divine ministers. God's love covers all the earth as the sky covers it, and also fills it in every pore. And this love has voices heard by all who have ears to hear. And so I think that of the many things that we've passed in the laws of the United States, the most eloquent were the words that created the wilderness system. And it's been my life. I would encourage you to visit. It's been fun.